Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of East of Eden by John Steinbeck, narrated by Richard Poe. This work is copyrighted 1980 by Elaine Steinbeck, Tom Steinbeck, and John Steinbeck IV. This recording is copyrighted 2002 by Recorded Books. John Steinbeck opens the book with a letter to his editor, Pascal Covici. Dear Pat, you came upon me carving some kind of little figure out of wood, and you said, "Why don't you make something for me?" I asked you what you wanted, and you said, "A box." "What for?" "To put things in." "What things?" "Whatever you have," you said. "Well, here's your box. Nearly everything I have is in it, and it is not full. Pain and excitement are in it, and feeling good or bad, and evil thoughts and good thoughts, the pleasure of design and some despair, and the indescribable joy of creation. And on top of these are all the gratitude and love I have for you. And still, the box is not full. John." And now, East of Eden.
Part 1. Chapter 1. The Salinas Valley is in Northern California. It's a long, narrow swale between two ranges of mountains, and the Salinas River winds and twists up the center until it falls at last into Monterey Bay. I remember my childhood names for grasses and secret flowers. I remember where a toad may live, and what time the birds awaken in the summer, and what trees and seasons smelled like, how people looked and walked and smelled even. The memory of odors is very rich. I remember that the Gabilan Mountains to the east of the valley were light, gay mountains, full of sun and loveliness and a kind of invitation, so that you wanted to climb into their warm foothills almost as you want to climb into the lap of a beloved mother. They were beckoning mountains with a brown grass love. The Santa Lucias stood up against the sky to the west and kept the valley from the open sea, and they were dark and brooding, unfriendly and dangerous. I always found in myself a dread of west and a love of east. Where I ever got such an idea, I can't say, unless it could be that the morning came over the peaks of the Gabilans and the night drifted back from the ridges of the Santa Lucias. It may be that the birth and death of the day had some part in my feeling about the two ranges of mountains. From both sides of the valley, little streams slipped out of the hill canyons and fell into the bed of the Salinas River. In the winter of wet years, the streams ran full freshet, and they swelled the river until sometimes it raged and boiled, bank full, and then it was a destroyer. The river tore the edges of the farmlands and washed whole acres down. It toppled barns and houses into itself to go floating and bobbing away. It trapped cows and pigs and sheep and drowned them in its muddy brown water and carried them to the sea. Then, when the late spring came, the river drew in from its edges and the sandbanks appeared. And in the summer, the river didn't run at all above ground. Some pools would be left in the deep swirl places under a high bank. The tules and grasses grew back and willows straightened up with the flood debris in their upper branches. The Salinas was only a part-time river. The summer sun drove it underground. It was not a fine river at all, but it was the only one we had, and so we boasted about it. How dangerous it was in a wet winter, and how dry it was in a dry summer. You can boast about anything if it's all you have. Maybe the less you have, the more you are required to boast. The floor of the Salinas Valley, between the ranges and below the foothills, is level, because this valley used to be the bottom of a 100-mile inlet from the sea. The river mouth at Moss Landing was, centuries ago, the entrance to this long inland water. Once, 50 miles down the valley, my father bored a well. The drill came up first with topsoil, and then with gravel, and then with white sea sand full of shells and even pieces of whalebone. There were 20 feet of sand, and then black earth again, and even a piece of redwood, that imperishable wood that doesn't rot. Before the inland sea, the valley must have been a forest. And those things had happened right under our feet. And it seemed to me sometimes at night that I could feel both the sea and the redwood forest before it. On the wide, level acres of the valley, the topsoil lay deep and fertile. It required only a rich winter of rain to make it break forth in grass and flowers. The spring flowers in a wet year were unbelievable. The whole valley floor, and the foothills too, would be carpeted with lupins and poppies. Once a woman told me that colored flowers would seem more bright if you added a few white flowers to give the colors definition. Every petal of a blue lupin is edged with white, so that a field of lupins is more blue than you can imagine. And mixed with these were splashes of California poppies. These too are of a burning color, not orange, not gold, but if pure gold were liquid and could raise a cream, that golden cream might be like the color of the poppies. When their season was over, the yellow mustard came up and grew to a great height. When my grandfather came into the valley, the mustard was so tall that a man on horseback showed only his head above the yellow flowers. On the uplands, the grass would be strewn with buttercups, with hen and chickens, with black-centered yellow violets. And a little later in the season, there would be red and yellow stands of Indian paintbrush. These were the flowers of the open places, exposed to the sun. Under the live oaks, shaded and dusky, the maidenhair flourished and gave a good smell. And under the mossy banks of the watercourses, whole clumps of five-fingered ferns and goldiebacks hung down. Then there were harebells, tiny lanterns, cream-white and almost sinful-looking. And these were so rare and magical that a child finding one felt singled out and special all day long. When June came, the grasses headed out and turned brown, and the hills turned to brown, which was not brown, but a gold and saffron and red, an indescribable color. And from then on until the next rains, the earth dried and the streams stopped. Cracks appeared on the level ground. The Salinas River sank under its sand. The wind blew down the valley, picking up dust and straws, and grew stronger and harsher as it went south. It stopped in the evening. It was a rasping, nervous wind, and the dust particles cut into a man's skin and burned his eyes. Men working in the fields wore goggles and tied handkerchiefs around their noses to keep the dirt out. The valley land was deep and rich, but the foothills wore only a skin of topsoil no deeper than the grass roots. And the farther up the hills you went, the thinner grew the soil, with flints sticking through, until at the brush line it was a kind of dry, flinty gravel that reflected the hot sun blindingly. I have spoken of the rich years when the rainfall was plentiful, but there were dry years too, and they put a terror on the valley. The water came in a 30-year cycle. There would be 5 or 6 wet and wonderful years, when there might be 19 to 25 inches of rain and the land would shout with grass. Then would come 6 or 7 pretty good years of 12 to 16 inches of rain, and then the dry years would come. And sometimes there would be only 7 or 8 inches of rain. The land dried up, and the grasses headed out miserably a few inches high, and great bare, scabby places appeared in the valley. The live oaks got a crusty look, and the sagebrush was gray. The land cracked, and the springs dried up, and the cattle listlessly nibbled dry twigs. Then the farmers and the ranchers would be filled with disgust for the Salinas Valley. The cows would grow thin and sometimes starve to death. People would have to haul water in barrels to their farms just for drinking. Some families would sell out for nearly nothing and move away. And it never failed that during the dry years, the people forgot about the rich years. And during the wet years, they lost all memory of the dry years. It was always that way. And that was the long Salinas Valley. Its history was like that of the rest of the state. First, there were Indians, an inferior breed, without energy, inventiveness, or culture. A people that lived on grubs and grasshoppers and shellfish, too lazy to hunt or fish. They ate what they could pick up and planted nothing. They pounded bitter acorns for flour. Even their warfare was a weary pantomime. Then the hard, dry Spaniards came exploring through, greedy and realistic, and their greed was for gold or God. They collected souls as they collected jewels. They gathered mountains and valleys, rivers and whole horizons, the way a man might now gain title to building lots. These tough, dried-up men moved restlessly up the coast and down. Some of them stayed on grants as large as principalities, given to them by Spanish kings who had not the faintest idea of the gift. These first owners lived in poor, feudal settlements, and their cattle ranged freely and multiplied. Periodically, the owners killed the cattle for their hides and tallow and left the meat to the vultures and coyotes. When the Spaniards came, they had to give everything they saw a name. This is the first duty of any explorer, a duty and a privilege. You must name a thing before you can note it on your hand-drawn map. Of course, they were religious people, and the men who could read and write, who kept the records and drew the maps, were the tough, untiring priests who traveled with the soldiers. Thus, the first names of places were saints' names or religious holidays celebrated at stopping places. There are many saints, but they are not inexhaustible, so that we find repetitions in the first namings. We have San Miguel, Saint Michael, San Ardo, San Bernardo, San Benito, San Lorenzo, San Carlos, San Francisquito. And then the holidays, Natividad, the Nativity, Nacimiento, the birth, Soledad, the solitude. But places were also named from the way the expedition felt at the time. Buena Esperanza, good hope. Buena Vista, because the view was beautiful. And Chualar, because it was pretty. The descriptive names followed. Paso de los Robles, because of the oak trees. Los Laureles, for the laurels. Tularcitos, because of the reeds in the swamp. And Salinas, for the alkali, which was white as salt. Then places were named for animals and birds seen. Gavilanes, for the hawks which flew in those mountains. Topo, for the mole. Los Gatos, for the wild cats. The suggestion sometimes came from the nature of the place itself. Tasajara, a cup and saucer. Laguna Seca, a dry lake. Corral de Tierra, for a fence of earth. Paraíso, because it was like heaven. Then the Americans came, more greedy because there were more of them. They took the lands, remade the laws to make their titles good. And farmholds spread over the land, first in the valleys and then up the foothill slopes. Small wooden houses roofed with redwood shakes, corrals of split poles. Wherever a trickle of water came out of the ground, a house sprang up, and a family began to grow and multiply. Cuttings of red geraniums and rose bushes were planted in the dooryards. Wheel tracks of buckboards replaced the trails, and fields of corn and barley and wheat squared out of the yellow mustard. Every 10 miles along the travel routes, a general store and blacksmith shop happened, and these became the nuclei of little towns, Bradley, King City, Greenfield. The Americans had a greater tendency to name places for people than had the Spanish. After the valleys were settled, the names of places refer more to things which happened there, And these, to me, are the most fascinating of all names, because each name suggests a story that has been forgotten. I think of Bolsa Nueva, a new purse, Moro Cojo, a lame Moor. Who was he, and how did he get there? Wild Horse Canyon, and Mustang Grade, and Shirttail Canyon. The names of places carry a charge of the people who name them, reverent or irreverent, descriptive, either poetic or disparaging. You can name anything San Lorenzo, but Shirttail Canyon or the Lame Moor is something quite different. The wind whistled over the settlements in the afternoon, and the farmers began to set out mile-long windbreaks of eucalyptus to keep the plowed topsoil from blowing away. And this is about the way the Salinas Valley was when my grandfather brought his wife and settled in the foothills to the east of King City. Chapter 2. I must depend on hearsay, on old photographs, on stories told, and on memories which are hazy and mixed with fable in trying to tell you about the Hamiltons. They weren't eminent people, and there are few records concerning them except for the usual papers on birth, marriage, land ownership, and death. Young Samuel Hamilton came from the north of Ireland, and so did his wife. He was the son of small farmers, neither rich nor poor, who had lived on one landhold and in one stone house for many hundreds of years. The Hamiltons managed to be remarkably well-educated and well-read, and, as is so often true in that green country, they were connected and related to very great people and very small people, so that one cousin might be a baronet and another cousin a beggar. And, of course, they were descended from the ancient kings of Ireland, as every Irishman is. Why Samuel left the stone house and the green acres of his ancestors, I do not know. He was never a political man, so it's not likely a charge of rebellion drove him out, and he was scrupulously honest, which eliminates the police as prime movers. There was a whisper, not even a rumor, but rather an unsaid feeling in my family, that it was love drove him out, and not love of the wife he married. But whether it was too successful love or whether he left in a peak at unsuccessful love, I do not know. We always preferred to think it was the former. Samuel had good looks and charm and gaiety. It's hard to imagine that any country Irish girl refused him. He came to the Salinas Valley full-blown and hearty, full of inventions and energy. His eyes were very blue, and when he was tired, one of them wandered outward a little. He was a big man, but delicate in a way. In the dusty business of ranching, he seemed always immaculate. His hands were clever. He was a good blacksmith and carpenter and woodcarver, and he could improvise anything with bits of wood and metal. He was forever inventing a new way of doing an old thing and doing it better and quicker. But he never in his whole life had any talent for making money. Other men who had the talent took Samuel's tricks and sold them and grew rich, but Samuel barely made wages all his life. I don't know what directed his steps toward the Salinas Valley. It was an unlikely place for a man from a green country to come to, but he came about 30 years before the turn of the century, and he brought with him his tiny Irish wife, a tight, hard little woman, humorless as a chicken. She had a dour Presbyterian mind and a code of morals that pinned down and beat the brains out of nearly everything that was pleasant to do. I don't know where Samuel met her, how he wooed her, married. I think there must have been some other girl printed somewhere in his heart, for he was a man of love, and his wife was not a woman to show her feelings. And in spite of this, in all the years from his youth to his death in the Salinas Valley, there was no hint that Samuel ever went to any other woman. When Samuel and Liza came to the Salinas Valley, all the level land was taken, the rich bottoms, the little fertile creases in the hills, the forests. But there was still marginal land to be homesteaded, and in the barren hills to the east of what is now King City, Samuel Hamilton homesteaded. He followed the usual practice. He took a quarter section for himself and a quarter section for his wife, and since she was pregnant, he took a quarter section for the child. Over the years, 9 children were born, 4 boys and 5 girls, and with each birth, another quarter section was added to the ranch. And that makes 11 quarter sections, or 1,760 acres. If the land had been any good, the Hamiltons would have been rich people. But the acres were harsh and dry. There were no springs, and the crust of topsoil was so thin that the flinty bones stuck through. Even the sagebrush struggled to exist, and the oaks were dwarfed from lack of moisture. Even in reasonably good years, there was so little feed that the cattle kept thin, running about looking for enough to eat. From their barren hills, the Hamiltons could look down to the west and see the richness of the bottom land and the greenness around the Salinas River. Samuel built his house with his own hands, and he built a barn and a blacksmith shop. He found quite soon that even if he had 10,000 acres of hill country, he couldn't make a living on the bony soil without water. His clever hands built a well-boring rig, and he bored wells on the lands of luckier men. He invented and built a threshing machine, and moved through the bottom farms in harvest time, threshing the grain his own farm would not raise. And in his shop, he sharpened plows and mended harrows and welded broken axles and shod horses. Men from all over the district brought him tools to mend and improve. Besides, they loved to hear Samuel talk of the world and its thinking, of the poetry and philosophy that were going on outside the Salinas Valley. He had a rich, deep voice, good both in song and in speech. And while he had no brogue, there was a rise and a lilt and a cadence to his talk that made it sound sweet in the ears of the taciturn farmers from the valley bottom. They brought whiskey, too, and out of sight of the kitchen window and the disapproving eye of Mrs. Hamilton, they took hot nips from the bottle and nibbled cuds of green wild anise to cover the whiskey breath. It was a bad day when 3 or 4 men weren't standing around the forge listening to Samuel's hammer and his talk. They called him a comical genius and carried his stories carefully home, and they wondered at how the stories spilled out on the way, for they never sounded the same repeated in their own kitchens. Samuel should have been rich from his well rig and his threshing machine and his shop, but he had no gift for business. His customers, always pressed for money, promised payment after harvest, and then after Christmas, and then after... until at last they forgot it. Samuel had no gift for reminding them, and so the Hamiltons stayed poor. The children came along as regularly as the years. The few overworked doctors in the county didn't often get to the ranches for a birth unless the joy turned nightmare and went on for several days. Samuel Hamilton delivered all his own children, and tied the cords neatly, spanked the bottoms, and cleaned up the mess. When his youngest was born with some small obstruction and began to turn black, Samuel put his mouth against the baby's mouth and blew air in and sucked it out until the baby could take over for himself. Samuel's hands were so good and gentle that neighbors from 20 miles away would call on him to help with a birth. And he was equally good with mare, cow, or woman. Samuel had a great black book on an available shelf, and it had gold letters on the cover, Dr. Gunn's Family Medicine. Some pages were bent and beat up from use, and others were never opened to the light. To look through Dr. Gunn is to know the Hamiltons' medical history. These are the used sections, broken bones, cuts, bruises, mumps, measles, backache, scarlet fever, diphtheria, rheumatism, female complaints, hernia, and, of course, everything to do with pregnancy and the birth of children. The Hamiltons must have been either lucky or moral, for the sections on gonorrhea and syphilis were never opened. Samuel had no equal for soothing hysteria and bringing quiet to a frightened child. It was the sweetness of his tongue and the tenderness of his soul. And just as there was a cleanness about his body, so there was a cleanness in his thinking. Men coming to his blacksmith shop to talk and listen dropped their cursing for a while, not from any kind of restraint, but automatically, as though this were not the place for it. Samuel kept always a foreignness. Perhaps it was the cadence of his speech, and this had the effect of making men, and women too, tell him things they would not tell to relatives or close friends. His slight strangeness set him apart and made him safe as a repository. Liza Hamilton was a very different kettle of Irish. Her head was small and round, and it held small, round convictions. She had a button nose and a hard little set-back chin, a gripping jaw set on its course, even though the angels of God argued against it. Liza was a good, plain cook, and her house, it was always her house, was brushed and pummeled and washed. Bearing her children didn't hold her back very much. 2 weeks at the most, she had to be careful. She must have had a pelvic arch of whalebone, for she had big children, one after the other. Liza had a finely developed sense of sin. Idleness was a sin, and card playing, which was a kind of idleness to her. She was suspicious of fun, whether it involved dancing or singing or even laughter. She felt that people having a good time were wide open to the devil. And this was a shame, for Samuel was a laughing man. But I guess Samuel was wide open to the devil. His wife protected him whenever she could. She wore her hair always pulled tight back and bunned behind in a hard knot. And since I can't remember how she dressed, it must have been that she wore clothes that matched herself exactly. She had no spark of humor, and only occasionally a blade of cutting wit. She frightened her grandchildren because she had no weakness. She suffered bravely and uncomplainingly through life, convinced that that was the way her God wanted everyone to live. She felt that rewards came later. When people first came to the West, particularly from the owned and fought-over farmlets of Europe, and saw so much land to be had for the signing of a paper and the building of a foundation, an itching land greed seemed to come over them. They wanted more and more land, good land if possible, but land anyway. Perhaps they had filaments of memory of feudal Europe, where great families became and remained great because they owned things. The early settlers took up land they didn't need and couldn't use. They took up worthless land just to own it. And all proportions changed. A man who might have been well-to-do on 10 acres in Europe was rat-poor on 2,000 in California. It wasn't very long until all the land in the barren hills near King's City and San Ardo was taken up, and ragged families were scattered through the hills, trying their best to scratch a living from the thin, flinty soil. They and the coyotes lived clever, despairing, submarginal lives. They landed with no money, no equipment, no tools, no credit, and particularly with no knowledge of the new country and no technique for using it. I don't know whether it was a divine stupidity or a great faith that let them do it. Surely such venture is nearly gone from the world. And the families did survive and grow. They had a tool or a weapon that is also nearly gone, or perhaps it is only dormant for a while. It's argued that because they believed thoroughly in a just, moral God, they could put their faith there and let the smaller securities take care of themselves. But I think that because they trusted themselves and respected themselves as individuals, because they knew beyond doubt that they were valuable and potentially moral units, because of this, they could give God their own courage and dignity and then receive it back. Such things have disappeared, perhaps because men don't trust themselves anymore. And when that happens, there's nothing left except perhaps to find some strong, sure man, even though he may be wrong, and to dangle from his coattails. While many people came to the Salinas Valley penniless, there were others who, having sold out somewhere else, arrived with money to start a new life. These usually bought land, but good land, and built their houses of plain lumber and had carpets and colored glass diamond panes in their windows. There were numbers of these families, and they got the good land of the valley, and cleared the yellow mustard away and planted wheat. Such a man was Adam Trask. Chapter 3. Adam Trask was born on a farm on the outskirts of a little town which was not far from a big town in Connecticut. He was an only son, and he was born 6 months after his father was mustered into a Connecticut regiment in 1862. Adam's mother ran the farm, bore Adam, and still had time to embrace a primitive theosophy. She felt that her husband would surely be killed by the wild and barbarous rebels, and she prepared herself to get in touch with him in what she called the beyond. He came home 6 weeks after Adam was born. His right leg was off at the knee. He stumped in on a crude wooden leg he himself had carved out of beechwood, and already it was splitting. He had in his pocket and placed on the parlor table the lead bullet they had given him to bite while they cut off his frayed leg. Adam's father, Cyrus, was something of a devil, had always been wild, drove a two-wheeled cart too fast, and managed to make his wooden leg seem jaunty and desirable. He had enjoyed his military career, what there was of it. Being wild by nature, he had liked his brief period of training and the drinking and gambling and whoring that went with it. Then he marched south with a group of replacements, and he enjoyed that too, seeing the country and stealing chickens and chasing rebel girls up into the haystacks. The gray, despairing weariness of protracted maneuvers in combat didn't touch him. The first time he saw the enemy was at 8 o'clock one spring morning, and at 8:30 he was hit in the right leg by a heavy slug that mashed and splintered the bones beyond repair. Even then he was lucky, for the rebels retreated and the field surgeons moved up immediately. Cyrus Trask did have his 5 minutes of horror while they cut the shreds away and sawed the bone off square and burned the open flesh. The tooth marks in the bullet proved that. And there was considerable pain while the wound healed under the unusually septic conditions in the hospitals of that day. But Cyrus had vitality and swagger. While he was carving his beechwood leg and hobbling about on a crutch, he contracted a particularly virulent dose of the clap from a Negro girl, who whistled at him from under a pile of lumber and charged him 10 cents. When he had his new leg and painfully knew his condition, he hobbled about for days looking for the girl. He told his bunkmates what he was going to do when he found her. He planned to cut off her ears and her nose with his pocket knife and get his money back. Carving on his wooden leg, he showed his friends how he would cut her. "When I finish her, she'll be a funny-looking bitch," he said. "I'll make her so a drunk Indian won't take out after her." His light of love must have sensed his intentions, for he never found her. By the time Cyrus was released from the hospital and the army, his gonorrhea was dried up. When he got home to Connecticut, there remained only enough of it for his wife. Mrs. Trask was a pale, inside-herself woman. No heat of sun ever reddened her cheeks, and no open laughter raised the corners of her mouth. She used religion as a therapy for the ills of the world, and of herself, and she changed the religion to fit the ill. When she found that the theosophy she had developed for communication with a dead husband was not necessary, she cast about for some new unhappiness. Her search was quickly rewarded by the infection Cyrus brought home from the war. And as soon as she was aware that a condition existed, she devised a new theology. Her god of communication became a god of vengeance. To her, the most satisfactory deity she had devised so far, and, as it turned out, the last. It was quite easy for her to attribute her condition to certain dreams she had experienced while her husband was away. But the disease was not punishment enough for her nocturnal philandering. Her new god was an expert in punishment. He demanded of her a sacrifice. She searched her mind for some proper egotistical humility and almost happily arrived at the sacrifice, herself. It took her 2 weeks to write her last letter with revisions and corrected spelling. In it, she confessed a crime she couldn't possibly have committed and admitted faults far beyond her capacity. And then, dressed in a secretly made shroud, she went out on a moonlight night and drowned herself in a pond so shallow that she had to get down on her knees in the mud and hold her head underwater. This required great willpower. As the warm unconsciousness finally crept over her, she was thinking, with some irritation, of how her white lawn shroud would have mud down the front when they pulled her out in the morning. And it did. Cyrus Trask mourned for his wife, with a keg of whiskey and three old army friends who had dropped in on their way home to Maine. Baby Adam cried a good deal at the beginning of the wake, for the mourners, not knowing about babies, had neglected to feed him. Cyrus soon solved the problem. He dipped a rag in whiskey and gave it to the baby to suck, and after three or four dippings, young Adam went to sleep. Several times during the mourning period, he awakened and complained and got the dipped rag again and went to sleep. The baby was drunk for 2 days and a half. Whatever may have happened in his developing brain, it proved beneficial to his metabolism. From that 2.5 days, he gained an iron health. And when, at the end of 3 days, his father finally went out and bought a goat, Adam drank the milk greedily, vomited, drank more, and was on his way. His father didn't find the reaction alarming, since he was doing the same thing. Within a month, Cyrus Trask's choice fell on the 17-year-old daughter of a neighboring farmer. The courtship was quick and realistic. There was no doubt in anybody's mind about his intentions. They were honorable and reasonable. Her father abetted the courtship. He had two younger daughters, and Alice, the eldest, was 17. This was her first proposal. Cyrus wanted a woman to take care of Adam. He needed someone to keep house and cook, and a servant cost money. He was a vigorous man and needed the body of a woman, and that too cost money, unless you were married to it. Within 2 weeks, Cyrus had wooed, wedded, bedded, and impregnated her. His neighbors didn't find his action hasty. It was quite normal in that day for a man to use up three or four wives in a normal lifetime. Alice Trask had a number of admirable qualities. She was a deep scrubber and a corner cleaner in the house. She wasn't very pretty, so there was no need to watch her. Her eyes were pale, her complexion sallow, and her teeth crooked, but she was extremely healthy and never complained during her pregnancy. Whether she liked children or not, no one ever knew. She wasn't asked, and she never said anything unless she was asked. From Cyrus's point of view, this was possibly the greatest of her virtues. She never offered any opinion or statement, and when a man was talking, she gave a vague impression of listening while she went about doing the housework. The youth, inexperience, and taciturnity of Alice Trask all turned out to be assets for Cyrus. While he continued to operate his farm as such farms were operated in the neighborhood, he entered on a new career, that of the old soldier. And that energy, which had made him wild, now made him thoughtful. No one now outside of the War Department knew the quality and duration of his service. His wooden leg was at once a certificate of proof of his soldiering and a guarantee that he wouldn't ever have to do it again. Timidly, he began to tell Alice about his campaigns, but as his technique grew, so did his battles. At the very first, he knew he was lying, but it wasn't long before he was equally sure that every one of his stories was true. Before he had entered the service, he hadn't been much interested in warfare. Now he bought every book about war, read every report, subscribed to the New York papers, studied maps. His knowledge of geography had been shaky, and his information about the fighting non-existent. Now he became an authority. He knew not only the battles, movements, campaigns, but also the units involved, down to the regiments, their colonels, and where they originated. And from telling, he became convinced that he had been there. All of this was a gradual development, and it took place while Adam was growing to boyhood and his young half-brother behind him. Adam and little Charles would sit silent and respectful while their father explained how every general thought and planned and where they had made their mistakes and what they should have done. And then, he had known it at the time, he had told Grant and McClellan where they were wrong and had begged them to take his analysis of the situation. Invariably, they refused his advice, and only afterward was he proved right. There was one thing Cyrus did not do, and perhaps it was clever of him. He never once promoted himself to non-commissioned rank. Private Trask he began, and Private Trask he remained. In the total telling, it made him at once the most mobile and ubiquitous private in the history of warfare. It made it necessary for him to be in as many as 4 places at once. But perhaps, instinctively, he didn't tell those stories close to each other. Alice and the boys had a complete picture of him, a private soldier, and proud of it, who not only happened to be where every spectacular and important action was taking place, but who wandered freely into staff meetings and joined or dissented in the decisions of general officers. The death of Lincoln caught Cyrus in the pit of the stomach. Always he remembered how he felt when he first heard the news, and he could never mention it or hear of it without quick tears in his eyes. And while he never actually said it, you got the indestructible impression that Private Cyrus Trask was one of Lincoln's closest, warmest, and most trusted friends. When Mr. Lincoln wanted to know about the army, the real army, not those prancing dummies in gold braid, he turned to Private Trask. How Cyrus managed to make this understood without saying it was a triumph of insinuation. No one could call him a liar, and this was mainly because the lie was in his head, and any truth coming from his mouth carried the color of the lie. Quite early he began to write letters and then articles about the conduct of the war, and his conclusions were intelligent and convincing. Indeed, Cyrus developed an excellent military mind. His criticism both of the war as it had been conducted and of the army organization as it persisted were irresistibly penetrating. His articles in various magazines attracted attention. His letters to the War Department, printed simultaneously in the newspapers, began to have a sharp effect in decisions on the army. Perhaps if the Grand Army of the Republic had not assumed political force and direction, his voice might not have been heard so clearly in Washington. But the spokesman for a block of nearly 1 million men was not to be ignored. And such a voice in military matters Cyrus Trask became. It came about that he was consulted in matters of army organization, in officer relationships, in personnel and equipment. His expertness was apparent to everyone who heard him. He had a genius for the military. More than that, he was one of those responsible for the organization of the GAR as a cohesive and potent force in the national life. After several unpaid offices in that organization, he took a paid secretaryship, which he kept for the rest of his life. He traveled from one end of the country to the other, attending conventions, meetings, and encampments. So much for his public life. His private life was also laced through with his new profession. He was a man devoted. His house and farm he organized on a military basis. He demanded and got reports on the conduct of his private economy. It's probable that Alice preferred it this way. She wasn't a talker. A terse report was easiest for her. She was busy with the growing boys and with keeping the house clean and the clothes washed. Also, she had to conserve her energy, though she didn't mention this in any of her reports. Without warning, her energy would leave her, and she would have to sit down and wait until it came back. In the night, she would be drenched with perspiration. She knew perfectly well that what she had was called consumption, would have known even if she wasn't reminded by a hard, exhausting cough. And she didn't know how long she would live. Some people wasted on for quite a few years. There wasn't any rule about it. Perhaps she didn't dare mention it to her husband. He had devised a method for dealing with sickness which resembled punishment. A stomach ache was treated with a purge so violent it was a wonder anyone survived it. If she had mentioned her condition, Cyrus might have started a treatment which would have killed her off before her consumption could have done it. Besides, as Cyrus became more military, his wife learned the only technique through which a soldier can survive. She never made herself noticeable, never spoke unless spoken to, performed what was expected and no more, and tried for no promotions. She became a rear-rank private. It was much easier that way. Alice retired to the background until she was barely visible at all. It was the little boys who really caught it. Cyrus had decided that even though the army wasn't perfect, it was still the only honorable profession for a man. He mourned the fact that he could not be a permanent soldier because of his wooden leg. But he couldn't imagine any career for his sons except the army. He felt a man should learn soldiering from the ranks as he had. Then he would know what it was about from experience, not from charts and textbooks. He taught them the manual of arms when they could barely walk. By the time they were in grade school, close-order drill was as natural as breathing and as hateful as hell. He kept them hard with exercises, beating out the rhythm with a stick on his wooden leg. He made them walk for miles, carrying knapsacks loaded with stones to make their shoulders strong. He worked constantly on their marksmanship in the woodlot behind the house. When a child first catches adults out, when it first walks into his grave little head that adults do not have divine intelligence, that their judgments are not always wise, their thinking true, their sentences just, his world falls into panic desolation. The gods are fallen and all safety gone. And there is one sure thing about the fall of gods. They don't fall a little. They crash and shatter or sink deeply into green muck. It is a tedious job to build them up again. They never quite shine, and the child's world is never quite whole again. It is an aching kind of growing. Adam found his father out. It wasn't that his father changed, but that some new quality came to Adam. He had always hated the discipline, as every normal animal does. But it was just and true and inevitable as measles, not to be denied or cursed, only to be hated. And then it was very fast, almost a click in the brain. Adam knew that, for him at least, his father's methods had no reference to anything in the world but his father. The techniques and training were not designed for the boys at all, but only to make Cyrus a great man. And the same click in the brain told Adam that his father was not a great man, that he was indeed a very strong-willed and concentrated little man wearing a huge busby. Who knows what causes this? A look in the eye, a lie found out, a moment of hesitation. Then God comes crashing down in a child's brain. Young Adam was always an obedient child. Something in him shrank from violence, from contention, from the silent, shrieking tensions that can rip at a house. He contributed to the quiet he wished for by offering no violence, no contention. And to do this, he had to retire into secretness, since there is some violence in everyone. He covered his life with a veil of vagueness, while behind his quiet eyes a rich, full life went on. This did not protect him from assault, but it allowed him an immunity. His half-brother Charles, only a little over a year younger, grew up with his father's assertiveness. Charles was a natural athlete, with instinctive timing and coordination, and the competitor's will to win over others, which makes for success in the world. Young Charles won all contests with Adam, whether they involved skill or strength or quick intelligence, and won them so easily that quite early he lost interest and had to find his competition among other children. Thus it came about that a kind of affection grew up between the two boys, but it was more like an association between brother and sister than between brothers. Charles fought any boy who challenged or slurred Adam, and usually won. He protected Adam from his father's harshness with lies and even with blame-taking. Charles felt for his brother the affection one has for helpless things, for blind puppies and new babies. Adam looked out of his covered brain, out the long tunnels of his eyes, at the people of his world. His father, a one-legged natural force at first, installed justly to make little boys feel littler and stupid boys aware of their stupidity. And then, after God had crashed, he saw his father as the policeman laid on by birth, the officer who might be circumvented or fooled but never challenged. And out of the long tunnels of his eyes, Adam saw his half-brother Charles as a bright being of another species, gifted with muscle and bone, speed and alertness, quite on a different plane, to be admired as one admires the sleek, lazy danger of a black leopard, not by any chance to be compared with oneself. And it would no more have occurred to Adam to confide in his brother, to tell him the hunger, the gray dreams, the plans and silent pleasures that lay at the back of the tunneled eyes, than to share his thoughts with a lovely tree or a pheasant in flight. Adam was glad of Charles the way a woman is glad of a fat diamond, and he depended on his brother in the way that same woman depends on the diamond's glitter and the self-security tied up in its worth. But love, affection, empathy were beyond conception. Toward Alice Trask, Adam concealed a feeling that was akin to a warm shame. She was not his mother. That he knew because he had been told many times. Not from things said, but from the tone in which other things were said, he knew that he had once had a mother, and that she had done some shameful thing, such as forgetting the chickens or missing the target on the range in the woodlot. And as a result of her fault, she was not here. Adam thought sometimes that if he could only find out what sin it was she had committed, why, he would sin it too and not be here. Alice treated the boys equally, washed them and fed them, and left everything else to their father, who had let it be known clearly and with finality that training the boys physically and mentally was his exclusive province. Even praise and reprimand he would not delegate. Alice never complained, quarreled, laughed, or cried. Her mouth was trained to a line that concealed nothing and offered nothing, too. But once, when Adam was quite small, he wandered silently into the kitchen. Alice didn't see him. She was darning socks, and she was smiling. Adam retired secretly and walked out of the house and into the woodlot to a sheltered place behind a stump that he knew well. He settled deep between the protecting roots. Adam was as shocked as though he had come upon her naked. He breathed excitedly, high against his throat. For Alice had been naked. She had been smiling. He wondered how she had dared such wantonness, and he ached toward her with a longing that was passionate and hot. He didn't know what it was about, but all the long lack of holding, of rocking, of caressing, the hunger for breast and nipple, and the softness of a lap, and the voice tone of love and compassion, and the sweet feeling of anxiety, all of these were in his passion, and he didn't know it, because he didn't know that such things existed, so how could he miss them? Of course, it occurred to him that he might be wrong, that some misbegotten shadow had fallen across his face and warped his seeing, and so he cast back to the sharp picture in his head and knew that the eyes were smiling too. Twisted light could do one or the other, but not both. He stalked her then, game-wise, as he had the woodchucks on the knoll when day after day he had lain lifeless as a young stone and watched the old wary chucks bring their children out to sun. He spied on Alice, hidden and from unsuspected eye corner. And it was true. Sometimes when she was alone, and knew she was alone, she permitted her mind to play in a garden, and she smiled. And it was wonderful to see how quickly she could drive the smile to earth, the way the woodchucks hold their children. Adam concealed his treasure deep in his tunnels, but he was inclined to pay for his pleasure with something. Alice began to find gifts in her sewing basket, in her worn-out purse, under her pillow. 2 cinnamon pinks, a bluebird's tail feather, 1/2 a stick of green sealing wax, a stolen handkerchief. At first, Alice was startled, but then that passed, and when she found some unsuspected present, the garden smile flashed and disappeared the way a trout crosses a knife of sunshine in a pool. She asked no questions and made no comment. Her coughing was very bad at night, so loud and disturbing that Cyrus had at last to put her in another room, or he would have got no sleep. But he did visit her very often, hopping on his one bare foot, steadying himself with hand on wall. The boys could hear and feel the jar of his body through the house as he hopped to and from Alice's bed. As Adam grew, he feared one thing more than any other. He feared the day he would be taken and enlisted in the army. His father never let him forget that such a time would come. He spoke of it often. It was Adam who needed the army to make a man of him. Charles was pretty near a man already. And Charles was a man, and a dangerous man, even at 15, and when Adam was 16. The affection between the two boys had grown with the years. It may be that part of Charles's feeling was contempt, but it was a protective contempt. It happened that one evening the boys were playing pee-wee, a new game to them, in the dooryard. A small pointed stick was laid on the ground, then struck near one end with a bat. The small stick flew into the air and then was batted as far as possible. Adam wasn't good at games, but by some accident of eye and timing, he beat his brother at pee-wee. 4 times he drove the pee-wee farther than Charles did. It was a new experience to him, and a wild flush came over him, so that he didn't watch and feel out his brother's mood as he usually did. The 5th time he drove the pee-wee, it flew humming like a bee far out in the field. He turned happily to face Charles, and suddenly he froze deep in his chest. The hatred in Charles's face frightened him. "I guess it was just an accident," he said lamely. "I bet I couldn't do it again." Charles set his pee-wee, struck it, and, as it rose into the air, swung at it and missed. Charles moved slowly toward Adam, his eyes cold and noncommittal. Adam edged away in terror. He didn't dare to turn and run, for his brother could outrun him. He backed slowly away, his eyes frightened and his throat dry. Charles moved close and struck him in the face with his bat. Adam covered his bleeding nose with his hands, and Charles swung his bat and hit him in the ribs, knocked the wind out of him, swung at his head and knocked him out. And as Adam lay unconscious on the ground, Charles kicked him heavily in the stomach and walked away. After a while, Adam became conscious. He breathed shallowly because his chest hurt. He tried to sit up and fell back at the wrench of the torn muscles over his stomach. He saw Alice looking out, and there was something in her face that he had never seen before. He didn't know what it was, but it wasn't soft or weak, and it might be hatred. She saw that he was looking at her, dropped the curtains into place, and disappeared. When Adam finally got up from the ground and moved, bent over, into the kitchen, he found a basin of hot water standing ready for him and a clean towel beside it. He could hear his stepmother coughing in her room. Charles had one great quality. He was never sorry, ever. He never mentioned the beating, apparently never thought of it again. But Adam made very sure that he didn't win again at anything. He had always felt the danger in his brother, but now he understood that he must never win unless he was prepared to kill Charles. Charles was not sorry. He had very simply fulfilled himself. Charles didn't tell his father about the beating, and Adam didn't, and surely Alice didn't, and yet he seemed to know. In the months that followed, he turned a gentleness on Adam. His speech became softer toward him, He didn't punish him anymore. Almost nightly he lectured him, but not violently. And Adam was more afraid of the gentleness than he had been at the violence, for it seemed to him that he was being trained as a sacrifice, almost as though he were being subjected to kindness before death, the way victims intended to the gods were cuddled